Okay, so what I'd like to do today is start off by presenting a robust mechanism that can lead to synchronization of behavior within groups of interacting units, then present data from two actual systems of insects that synchronize their behavior within groups using these types of mechanisms, and then touch finally briefly on some of the functional aspects of why you might want to synchronize your behavior and what it can do for you. Okay, so synchronization of behavior within groups of interacting units is common in a lot of different biological systems. Probably the most spectacular one is types of fireflies that exist in Southeast Asia. So fireflies, as you know, are basically pulsed oscillators that flash on, off, on, off, on, off, in a periodic sort of way. Now, most of the fireflies that we know in North America, each individual is periodic, but if you have a population, there's no synchronicity between them. You know, each one's flashing according to its own rhythm. They might have, they all have the same period, but their phases are completely different. They're not in alignment, the delays. These particular species of fireflies that are found in Indonesia, the Philippines, places like that, synchronize. So you get an entire tree of fireflies where each one is flashing on and off, but they're all flashing together in sync. And this obviously is quite spectacular to look at, and that's been described since a very long time ago from people who have seen this, because you have entire trees that light up in the unison. And you have not only entire trees, but you have mile upon mile of trees along riverbanks. So if you're sailing down this river, you just have this whole corridor of lights that are flashing on and off together. So it's spectacular. Another example of synchronization of animal behavior that's perhaps less spectacular is that of the activity of ants. This is work that was done by Blaine Cole almost 15 years ago now, where an individual ant switches between being active and inactive according to a certain rhythm that isn't entirely periodic. If you then get groups of ants, and this here is simulation data, so when you have an individual ant, it's one active, zero inactive, one active, zero quiet. You get groups of ants, you start getting these kinds of pulses that get more and more synchronized as your group size increases, until down here you have a group size of about 100 individuals where practically everybody is active, then everybody's quiet, everybody's active, everybody's quiet. So you get beautiful synchronization of behavior among all the individuals of the colony, and not only is it synchronized, but in this case it's nicely periodic, even though the individual wasn't quite as nicely periodic. Okay, so the question that I'm interested in, therefore, is how does this happen? Now, obviously, the most simple, straightforward, obvious mechanism by which things could synchronize is by following external cues. So if you had some kind of external thing in the environment, everybody responds to it in the same way, everybody becomes synchronized. So an obvious example of that would be circadian rhythms. You know, we all wake up at about the same time in the morning, we all go back to bed at about the same time at night, and that's because we're all responding to the external day-night cycle. Except for those of us who are jet lagged, so it's not perfect. So there is a combination of the endogenous and the exogenous. But I think in these two examples here, it seems pretty clear that there isn't any exogenous rhythm involved. There isn't some kind of magic thing in the air in Indonesia that's pulsing at once per second that all the fireflies are following. They're not following some kind of external pacemaker. What's happening is each one's an oscillator, and they're interacting with each other, and they're somehow bringing their different rhythms into phase, into synchronicity. Now, how this works has mainly been described with the fireflies. So I'm going to go into the mechanisms here using the fireflies as the example, but it's basically a generalized mechanism that I'll then apply to the locust and the caterpillar situations. So what's been done is if you observe an individual firefly, so each one of these lines here is an individual, it essentially oscillates or pulses in a periodic way, and the individual periods here tend to be around 950 milliseconds. So, you get pulse here, 975 pulse, 990 pulse, 950 pulse, 940 pulse, so on. So we've got this pretty close to perfectly periodic rhythm in an isolated individual. What you then get here in individual B1 is that, it's got its periodic pulsing. You then expose it to a flash of light, so an external stimulus, which basically means it sees the pulse of another individual here halfway through its cycle. And then what happens is its next pulse occurs 1,355 milliseconds after its previous pulse. So its next pulse has been delayed, relative to what it would have been if the animal was on its own. And it's been delayed so that it matches, basically, the next pulse of the individual that it's seen. So by delaying the phase of its own, retarding the phase of its own oscillation, or delaying the time that it does its next pulse, it brings itself into alignment with this individual that is detected. You see the same thing happening here, where individual B2 has seen this pulse further on in its cycle. You get the same thing. Here you get a much longer delay, where the interval between the two pulses is extremely long. But it's happening, 940 milliseconds after the pulse that it's seen. So it's bringing it into phase with its neighbor. Now, how actually fireflies do this to adjust the phase of their own internal oscillation based on that of its neighbors has been investigated, again using the firefly example, but using light-controlled oscillators, or sort of essentially robot fireflies, where each one of these individuals here is essentially an oscillator, which then gives off a pulse of light, and it also has a photodetector by which it detects the pulses of lights of its neighbors. And so how these things work, then, is that each one of these robot fireflies, its oscillation, it's basically a pulsed oscillation that's based on a capacitor. So you have a capacitor that charges slowly in time, according to the standard curve at which capacitors charge. It's charging, and here it reaches a maximum threshold level. You get current set up in the circuit. It discharges. That then leads to a pulse of light occurring. Your charge is now zero, and it starts to charge gradually again. So that gives you your regular oscillation of capacitor charging, discharge, flash, start charging again, discharge, flash. And then the timing between the flashes is based on the time that it takes for that charge to build up across the capacitor. What then happens here is if this individual then, through its photodetector, perceives a flash of one of its neighboring individuals at this moment in time here, essentially what happens is the charge of its capacitor gets reset down to zero. So essentially, instead of being at this point in its oscillation, it kind of gets wound back in time to being this point here, or, its phase gets changed. And so then it keeps charging again, and then what happens here is your flash occurs at the appropriate delay after the time here when it was reset to zero. Okay, so it's a pretty straightforward and simple mechanism. Now, I think for some of the engineers in the audience, you might be saying, well, this is a phase locking. There's one in every single FM radio. This is straightforward. I learned this as an undergraduate. Why is this novel or interesting? I think there's two things. It's not completely novel. You notice most of the work I've cited so far is that of other people, and a lot of the mathematics was worked out sort of 20 years ago. What makes it interesting, though, is that we're not talking about a situation here where you have a reference oscillator and then a tunable oscillator that follows the reference. In this situation, both are tunable. So they're both adjusting each other according to their neighbors. Every single one of these robots has got a photodetector, and everyone is responding to the other individual. So that's already a little bit more hairy. Now, for the system of two oscillators, this has been worked out mathematically, and again, this was done a number of years ago by someone other than me. But once you start getting to systems of more than two oscillators, the math becomes pretty intractable. Here you've got an array of nine, and what Marcelo Ramirez Avila has done is show that in these groups of nine, he's shown it both in numerical simulations and with these actual, physical models, that in groups of nine, you can get synchronization among these nine individuals, even though all these individuals are responding to each other. Now, in this robot case, we have groups of nine. When you're talking about trees full of fireflies, it's groups of much more than nine, thousands. So it's a mechanism that is robust and that can operate even in very large populations. Okay, now what does any of the... Now, I think to further illustrate this mechanism, I'd like to do a little experiment with you guys. So you're all going to need a hard object with which to tap against the arms of your chairs. So a coin, a key, a pen, something like that. You can borrow something from your neighbor, because you won't need it for very long. So has everybody got something? Okay, so the first part of the experiment, okay, to do this properly, you're all supposed to close your eyes to make sure that you're responding to sound cues and not to visual cues. And the first part is I'll tap my thing, and then you should all tap as fast as you can after I've tapped. Okay? So we can get people to close your eyes, and then when I tap, you tap as soon as you can afterwards, okay? No, just once. Just once. Sorry about that. We'll do it again, but I think that the main thing you want to notice is, first of all, there's a delay between my tap and yours, and secondly, there's a certain amount of spread when you respond. So let's just do that again. So you tap only once. Okay. So I think you all heard that there was a delay. Typically, the delay, the average is around 200 milliseconds, and that's based on, you know, human reaction time, how fast you can contract your muscles. The fastest people are at about 150 milliseconds. And then you have a long spread out here of slower people, which might be linked to perhaps people farther away and the speed of sound comes into effect and so on. So first of all, there's a certain delay and there's a certain variance, a certain spread. Now the next part of the experiment is we're going to get you to, again, close your eyes and this time tap rhythmically. Just start tapping and see if you can synchronize your tapping with that of everybody else. And I'm not going to start, so you're not going to have a leader. You're just each going to start tapping. Okay, so I think it's pretty obvious here that that very fast you got to be pretty synchronized. Not perfect, but pretty good. And again, if you look at data from typical individuals, after very few taps, they very fast become synchronized. They start tapping in unison. And once they're in unison, again, of course, it's not perfect. There's a certain amount of spread. But the spread that you see here is much smaller than the spread you see there. So what we're demonstrating with this is not only that, you know, new people are as smart as fireflies.
Are we?
Well, there's not as many of you. We'd have to try a group of 10,000 spread over a couple of miles, but that's not very practical in this case. But I think what we're demonstrating here is that the mechanism that you're using is not, I will listen to my neighbors and tap as soon as I can after my neighbor. Because if you were doing that, there'd be a 200 millisecond delay, and we'd never get the kind of synchrony we do here. So instead, what's happening is that you're each getting into a pretty regular kind of periodic rhythm. And usually for most people, that's about 2 to 3 taps per second, which was about what you were doing. So you're normal. So each one of you has a rhythm, and then you're slightly, and your rhythms are all pretty similar. And I guess that has to do with the biomechanics of the way people's hands are put together. And then you're slightly adjusting your rhythms to match that of your neighbors. And the level of synchrony that you can achieve is much better than that you would have predicted from this here. It's much better than the delay that you have in responding to taps from others. So essentially what you were doing there is the exact same mechanism as what our fireflies were doing.
But in this particular case, I was not trying to adjust my rhythm to my neighbors, but to someone else who was at the back of the room, because that was the loudest.
So that then becomes a question of who's your neighbor. Is your neighbor only the guy beside you, or are you connected to everybody in the room? And that then becomes a really fundamental and interesting question of how many neighbors do you have, and how many connections do you have between neighbors? And so that certainly shows up if we go back to these robot things. If you put them in this configuration, you know, this guy has got 4 neighbors, this one's got 2 neighbors, they synchronize extremely fast. If you spread them out in a line, it's much slower because you have lower connectivity between neighbors. If you spread them out far enough to have very low connectivity, it gets even worse. So that is a fundamental question of how many neighbors do you have and how coupled are you with the rest of the individuals. Right, so if that's okay, I want to then move on to the question of what does this have to do?
That's a good question. So the individuals themselves don't necessarily need to have it. Some inherent periodicity, do they? Because the ants, for example, don't have inherent periodicity.
No. So the conditions in which you get synchronization depend on whether you have inherent periodicity or not. And it's obviously, you have a much wider range of parameter values where you would get synchronization with periodicity. Interestingly enough, you can get synchronization that's not periodic. But that's... Okay, so if we then... What then does this have to do with behaviors of groups of insects? And that really gets back to the question that you just asked, is that insects, and animals as a rule, are basically oscillators. This is where there's a certain oscillation between get hungry, look for food, eat it, get full, rest, digest, get hungrier, look for food, eat it, get full, so on. Now that's probably a not very helpful analogy for human behavior in general, because there's a lot of other things going on. But when you're looking at individual locusts, that pretty much sums up a lot of what they do. And so this then is work that Steve did quite a number of years ago, of actually sitting down and watching an individual locust for many hours at a time and recording what it does. And you can see that essentially the probability that it has to start to feed increases with the time since its last meal, which is obvious, which is true for all the rest of us. The curve here that you see here is pretty much the same as that charging on that capacitor. So essentially, if you think of this as kind of a hunger charge, that hunger charge increases with time and until it reaches a certain point where the animal becomes active, looks for food, eats it. Once it's eaten it, hunger drops back to zero, and then it starts increasing again. Now, obviously, this being a real biological system, it's not perfect. It's probabilistic. The animal doesn't always wait till it's exactly 100% hungry to start feeding, but its probability of starting to feed increases as time goes on. Now, its propensity to become active, therefore, is strongly dependent on this time since its last meal, or its sort of hunger charge. It's also influenced by other factors, such as the odors of food, for example, which is obvious, or the presence of light. So if you combine all that together, and then this, again, is simulation data, where you look at this kind of hunger function over time, it's, pretty far from a clean sine wave, because it's being influenced by all these different things. But you do have this sort of oscillatory pattern, which is based on this hunger oscillation. What then happens here is this red line is a sort of threshold that when it goes beyond that threshold, the animal starts to locomote, finds a food source, and feeds. So what happens here is its feeding oscillation, excitation is increasing at time. It reaches a threshold, it starts to feed. When it reaches a food source, you have a short-term feedback that stimulates it to increase its hunger, so it eats more. As it eats, then, of course, its hunger goes down, drops down to a very low level, starts resting again, and then gradually starts increasing. Now this, of course, feeding excitation or hunger is something you can't measure on a real animal, so that's simulation data. What you can, however, measure is its meals. And so what you see, the meals here, are these peaks above the red line. And if you compare that with real data of the pattern of feeding of a locust, you get very similar patterns, where it's not entirely periodic, but very close to it. So you have this relatively rhythmic, regular feeding that's based on this underlying oscillation in hunger. Okay, so that then means if individual locusts, and by extension probably other animals, behave essentially as oscillators based on this hunger function, you could imagine a situation where stimuli from neighbors, seeing a neighbor move by you, for example, might act as a stimulus to shift the phase of that hunger oscillation in the same way that seeing a flash of a neighboring firefly shifts the phase of an individual firefly's cycle. And so therefore, seeing one of your neighbors move by or being bumped by one of your neighbors as it moves by could then change the probability at which you become active, therefore shift the phase of your own hunger oscillation, bring it in line with that of your neighbor, and hence synchronize your behavior. And so that's the hypothesis that I want to explore here. And I'm going to look into this with two different experimental systems. This first one is locusts. And the main reason we're using locusts is because we have this very good data about the individual characteristics as an oscillator. And we're then going to take that to say, given that we know individual locusts are oscillators, do they interact with each other to bring hunger oscillations into alignment? Now, in some ways, locusts aren't really the best system to study this, because locusts don't really show the very clear, beautiful, cohesive, synchronized collective behavior that you see in some other systems, which is why I'm going to move on to another system, which is these social caterpillars, which do show much more cohesive collective behavior, to then see do these same mechanisms operate in the caterpillar system. So more specifically, in the locust system, the question is going to be whether stimuli from neighboring locusts can influence the probability the locust becomes active, and by doing so, reset the phase of its hunger oscillation, given that we know that locusts are basically oscillators. The second question with locusts, then, is what's the effect of the structure of the environment? We know that, I think we remember from Steve's talk this morning, we know that the structure of the environment influences contact between the individuals. If it's influencing contact, it's influencing coupling between the oscillators, in the way that you were saying about how, you know, you're able to hear multiple individuals in the room. So does then this effect of resource distribution influence the degree of synchronization that you observe? And then we're going to move on to the caterpillar system to see whether this interplay between individual physiological cycles and interactions between neighbors can explain the cohesive synchronized collective foraging that we see in caterpillars. And the caterpillar work is very much kind of preliminary, still work in progress. So on that, I'd welcome any kind of comments people might have. Okay, now before we start looking at the locusts, I just want to briefly present the kind of methodology that we've been using here, which has been essentially to investigate collective behavior. What we've been doing is start off here by observing the system both at the group level and the individual level to see what's the group level phenomenon that we're interested in. In this case, it's synchronization of behavior. The next question is, what's going on at the individual level? What are the actual behavioral rules that the individuals are following? Once you've got a pretty good idea of both, the next question is then to formulate a model that can tie these two together. Can say that, well, these individual rules that we observe our individuals doing, can they explain what we see at the collective level, yes or no? Once you've got an idea of a model, you then measure your parameters at your individual level. And so that gives you actual parameter values or, you know, hard empirical data, which you can then plug into your model. And I've said simulations here simply because the models we used were simulations, but the same concept applies if you're using, you know, mathematical analytical models. You plug in your parameter values that you've derived from your individual level experiments. You then use that model to predict your group level dynamics. You then go back to your group level experiments. You say, well, you know, do my model predictions match what I see in the real world? If they do, that's a pretty strong indication that your model is valid. It's obviously not complete proof, but you've shown that these individual rules that you've observed with these parameter values that you've measured can give you this phenomenon that you're seeing. Doesn't mean it's necessarily what does. You know, for the longest time, the geocentric model of the universe gave excellent predictions of, you know, movements of the planets. So it seemed to work. It's just, so you compare. If it works, you think it's good. If it doesn't work, what you then need to do is return back to this level here where you do new experiments, you measure new parameters, you measure your individual level behavior in greater detail. You then refine your model and keep doing the circle. Okay, so if we then move on to the locust system, so if we just have a bit of a refresher, the locusts we know are oscillators, so the question is, are these oscillators coupled by stimuli exchange between individuals? Now, in practice, the way we formulate that question such that we can answer it with an experiment is, does the presence of active neighbors influence the probability that a locust becomes active in the next time step? So in other words, do interactions with neighbors stimulate the activity of individual locusts? And the answer here is that yes, they do. So this first here, P, A, given I, is the probability that an individual locust becomes active given that it's isolated, given that it doesn't have any neighbors. And the value you have here is, it's measured, but it's arbitrary because it depends on the time frame in which you're measuring it. What's important is the relative value between the two. The second one here is the probability that a locust become active given that it's in contact with an active neighbor. And this value is obviously twice as much as this value here. So essentially what that means is that for a locust, having an active neighbor means that if, for example, the locust was here on its curve of hunger increasing with time, if it's here, it has an active neighbor go by, it's been bumped up to here. So the time to its next meal has been changed, the probability of it starting a meal has been changed, the phase of its hunger oscillation has been changed. Now, one thing I forgot to mention that I should probably get back to is that when I'm talking about locusts here, I think if you remember from Steve's talk, the important factor about locusts that's really key to understanding their biology is that they have this change from a solitarious form to a swarming gregarious form. So in the solitarious form, they're low-density populations. They basically behave like grasshoppers. They avoid each other. When you increase population density, they change to the swarming form. And this involves a change in color and behavior and morphology. But this change is triggered by contact between individuals. So the locusts I'm talking about here are solitarious locusts that have been crowded and that have begun this transition to the gregarious phase. So the context I'm looking at is not within swarms of locusts, but it's within kind of incipient swarms of locusts. You have these solitarious locusts that have been brought into contact by their environment. In this situation, do you get synchronization of behavior in the groups? In terms of the individual level rules, we have the individuals are basically oscillators. We have coupling between those oscillators that shifts their phase, and so that suggests that, yes, the mechanisms are there that would allow us to get synchronization. Okay, to go from that, now that we've, you know, got our individual rules and measured our parameters, the next thing is then to build a model. And this is basically a schematic of what's a very simple simulation model, where your locus starts off being inactive. It then has a certain probability of becoming inactive, and it's obviously got the reverse probability of remaining inactive. And its probability of becoming inactive depends on whether it has neighbors or not. So here, if the distance to the nearest neighbor is large, your probability of becoming active is that fixed probability of becoming active given that you're isolated. It's a certain value. If, however, if you have a neighbor that's closer to that, you have a probability of becoming active that's higher, and that depends on the distance to your neighbor. So if your neighbor is actually in physical contact with you, it is a very strong, much stronger influence on your probability of becoming active than does a neighbor that's just passing by. Yes?
Just briefly, the probability seems very low. Is that?
Yeah, well, that depends on the time step that you're looking at.
I'm just wondering how significant it is that the second one is twice the point. First, the probability of the PAI is only 0.06, right?
Yeah.
So it's 0.13.
Oh, the other one is 0.13, so it's double, effectively. So yeah, the values are low because we're looking at small time steps. Locusts basically most of the time do nothing.
Right.
And then they sit immobile for long periods of time and then they become active. So what this value here is an overall expected value over time at any given time step, what's the probability of becoming active? Because when you're doing an experiment, you can't know where they're at in that hunger oscillation. So it's the overall expected value of that. And then this is the overall expected value if it's in contact with a moving neighbor. But the question of whether it's significant, I guess, is what comes out of both the model and the experiment. Okay, so then...
Did you say how you get those numbers?
You watch locusts and you measure...
You watch a large number of locusts.
Yeah.
All at once.
Yeah, right. So you have a bunch of locusts that are in a group in an arena, and you watch them, and here we discretize time because just simply the time it takes to watch them. And so you observe for every time step how many of them are active. And then from that, you can back calculate what's your probability each time step of getting active. So yeah, they're empirically based. Okay, so you have your probability of becoming active that depends on whether you have neighbors or not. Once you're active, you go to the nearest food patch based on the probability that's linked to the distance to that food patch. If you don't go to the nearest food patch, you just move randomly and then you become inactive again. And this tends to only happen if food patches are very far away. Once you go to a food patch, you eat. As when you start eating, your hunger value goes down. You continue eating until your hunger value, which is T here, reaches a certain threshold, at which point you stop eating and you become inactive. And it's very simple. the advantage then of doing this as a model rather than only doing the experiments is that you can then look at what happens to the internal hunger oscillations. Because obviously you can't somehow, you know, stick an electrode on a locust and measure how hungry it is. You can only look at when it feeds and then probabilistically work out, you know, how the hunger value changes in time. If, however, you've got a model, what you're doing here is you're modeling that hunger function according to all these different parameters. And then you can look at this hunger function as your model output. And what you see here is basically each one of these different colors is a different individual. And the curves represent that hunger value in time. So with time since the last meal, it increases. As it starts to feed, it drops down to zero, and then it gradually starts increasing again, and so on. What's interesting here is that you have these kind of periods here where a lot of individuals are becoming active at the same time. So what you're getting here is a certain form of synchronization where an individual being active is then triggering these neighboring individuals to become active. So you have period, you have moments here where a lot of individuals are becoming active at the same time, and that's bringing those oscillations into a certain degree of alignment. The other thing worth noting is this is far from perfect. We wouldn't call this beautifully synchronized by any stretch of the imagination. That I'll get back to later, but it is more synchronized than you'd expect based on a random model with no interactions, because you have this kind of clumping in time of multiple individuals being active at the same time. Okay, if we then want to compare this with actual, you know, empirical observations of the group level phenomenon, to do that, that then kind of leads on to the next question of the effective environmental structure. Okay, now the effective environmental structure is important, I think, for two reasons. First of all, when you're looking at the actual habitats that these animals live in, it's the desert. Desert vegetation is inherently patchy. It tends to look like this, where you have, you know, patches of edible vegetation and then a bunch of bare soil in between. So patchiness of the vegetation is a real thing that actually these animals are confronted with. Secondly, as Steve mentioned this morning, the environment, the structure of the environment very much influences contact between individuals and hence change the gregarious form. And that's simply because these animals, being in the solitarious form, tend to avoid each other. If, however, the food is clumped, you know, a locust that's here hasn't got much of a choice but to go to the food source to feed and will then come in contact with other individuals that have been attracted to this food source. So the food sources act as attractants that bring locusts together over a large area. If this kind of clumpiness of the vegetation increases contact rate between individuals, well, contact rate in this case means coupling between the oscillators. And so you'd expect a greater degree of synchronization when the food is clumped than when it's dispersed. So the first question then is, does environmental structure influence contact rate? To test this, we essentially put groups of locusts in arenas where the food is distributed according to different patterns. So here the food is all concentrated in a single clump. Here it's spread out randomly throughout the area. And then we measure, is the contact rate different, you know, between these three separate situations? And the answer is that yes, it is. That contact between individuals is much higher when the food is clumped. And this is, you know, exactly what Steve said this morning. So given then that contact rate increases as your vegetation is clumped, does this then influence synchronization of behavior between individuals? And the answer is that yes, it does. So what this is here is each one of these graphs shows the frequency distribution of the number of active locusts per time step. So if our locusts are completely independent of each other and they're not interacting, you'd expect this curve to follow the binomial, which is this brown line here, which is centered over the average value. Because any locust can be either active or inactive. So if you have a group of 10 locusts at any given time, the number that are active should follow a binomial distribution. So in the case where the vegetation is dispersed, the real data here, which is the blue line, is pretty close to the binomial. So most of the time you have 2, 3, 4 locusts active. Very seldom is nobody moving, and very seldom are everybody moving. So in this case of dispersed vegetation, you can't really say that you've got synchronization going on. Effectively, the animals are completely uncoupled. They're dependent on each other, or pretty close to it. In the situation where the food is clumped, however, you see a much stronger departure from the binomial. So you have a much larger number of cases where you have 0 or 1 individuals active, so most of the population is quiet, And you have a much larger number of cases where a large proportion of the population is active. So you have a certain amount of synchronization happening here when this thing is formed. Okay, so that then suggests that locusts can, to a certain extent, synchronize their behavior by shifting the phase of each other's hunger oscillations, and the extent to which this happens depends on the structure of the environment. So that kind of answers the how question of the mechanistic, how does synchronization happen? Now the other obvious question that I think comes to most people's mind is why? You know, what does this do for locusts? What's the advantage of this? And I think the answer there has to do with this swarm-forming process, or this change to the gregarious form. So essentially, here we're looking at solitarius locusts. When they're at low population density, this becoming active when you're contacted by an active neighbor is basically an escape response. So you're sitting here minding your own business, your neighbor comes by, bumps into you, you jump away. So what that does is it effectively lowers the contact rate or lowers the kind of experienced population density. If, however, you're in a situation here where you have high population density, each one of these little things here is a locust, and they're all attracted towards these plants because they want to eat them. So in a situation like that, escape responses don't happen. If one of these individuals becomes active, it'll contact a lot of neighbors. Those neighbors can't go away, so you have a sort of increase in contact rate due to the clumping of the vegetation. If then that contact leads to synchronization of the behavior of this whole group, well, that will then in turn increase the contact rate further. Because if everybody here is moving together, you have a lot more contact happening than if individuals are moving separately. And so what synchronization does is add a further feedback loop that in situations like this accelerates the change to the gregarious form. When behavior is synchronized, it further accelerates, increases the contact rate, which then accelerates the change to the gregarious form. So Steve was saying earlier that behavior, this behavioral change from a solitarius to a gregarious form, acts as a feedback loop to basically lead it to a more extreme function of two stable situations, either solitarius or gregarious. Synchronization here is an additional feedback mechanism that further drives the situation to either gregarious or solitarius and away from the intermediate values. So that's about all I'm going to say about locusts. In some ways, locusts really aren't the best system to study synchronization of behavior because they're not that synchronized. I think that's pretty obvious in the data that I've shown. You've got, sure, your synchronization is greater than what you get in the random model, but it's far from perfect. It's far from complete synchronization. Now, there are a lot of other social animals that show much greater degrees of synchronization. One of those are social caterpillars. So
excuse
this,
me, can I just ask you before you start with this? So you concluded the first part of the talk, or the part that you just finished, by saying that synchronization is an additional mechanism. Is that right? I mean, additional mechanism, and I just got confused about that. So
okay.
It's a sentence. So what are the two mechanisms?
Okay.
For what? Yeah.
Okay, so for driving the change from the solitarius to the gregarious form,
yes.
The behavioral change is a first feedback loop, that once you start behaving gregariously, it...
But that is the result, right?
Okay, the
yeah,
change
so
from...
This
okay.
is what confused me.
Yeah,
so
yeah, because there's multiple levels here. The change from the solitarius to the gregarious form includes a change in behavior. It also includes a change in coloration and morphology and so on. What's key about the change in behavior is once you start behaving gregariously, you come in contact with your neighbors more often. And so the change in behavior accelerates the change to the gregarious form. And so it's been shown, for example, if you, with a simulation, remove the behavioral change, but increase population density, you still have higher contact, but that contact will increase less fast than if you include the behavioral change. Now, the synchronization change is an additional feedback loop over on that, where because you when your behavior is synchronized, the contact rate between crowded individuals increases even faster than if the behavior were not synchronized. And so it's an additional feedback mechanism that then really drives the population to either being gregarious and swarming or solitarious, but not in between the two. Does that make more sense?
not to me, but please let me not stop you. But
we can get back to it later. Okay, so this animal is the forest tent caterpillar, which if you've spent much time looking at fruit trees in North America, you've probably seen. There's a number of species of tent caterpillars. They all show, okay, they all live in colonies. So the eggs are laid in masses of about 100 to 200 individuals. Those individuals hatch out together, and they stay together in a colony. And they'll exhibit very synchronized behavior, where everybody rests together. And then depending on the species of tent caterpillar we're talking about, they're either on a little bivouac or they're in an elaborate tent. Then everybody gets up from the resting space together to go and feed on the foliage, and then they come back to their resting spot. So again, if you've looked at fruit trees much, you've probably seen the tents of these things. Okay, so these animals really exhibit much more cohesive, synchronized, collective activity. And so the question then is, in this system, are the same mechanisms operating? So if we just get back to using the same approach, we'll start off by looking at the individual level rules. Here, the first rule that you need, obviously, is that your individuals act as oscillators, so that your caterpillars, therefore, individually show this cycle between activity and inactivity based on their hunger cycles. And again, that appears to be the case. The next rule that you need is that your individuals will tend to follow the behavior of your others. That is to say that your caterpillars will be affected by stimuli coming from their neighbors that will tend to align their behavior with that of their neighbors, and hence to bring those hunger cycles into phase. If you then combine this into a model, and then here this is obviously extremely schematic, but if you have here a resting spot, which is the tent or the bivouac where your caterpillar is resting, you then have the feeding site, which is the foliage. So in a natural system, this will tend to be at a V between a crook between two branches, and this is out where the foliage actually is. The probability that any individual caterpillar will go from the resting spot to the foliage depends, first of all, on its own physiological state, on how hungry it is. And it'll depend, secondly, on this kind of social entrainment factor, or on the influence of its neighbors. And here we're assuming that if an individual has active neighbors, it's much more likely to become active than it doesn't have active neighbors. And then conversely, the probability that a caterpillar that's active and feeding will return to the resting state will depend, first of all, on its physiological state, so how hungry it is, and secondly, again, on the social entrainment, or on the behavior of its neighbors, where there, again, it'll be stimulated by the action of its neighbors to do the same thing as what its neighbors do. Now, in terms of predictions, what does this model give you? Here we're looking at the very simple case of only two individuals. And this is, again, still very kind of simplistic and schematic. If you have only two individuals that are completely independent of each other, and you look at the number of individuals that are foraging at any given time, we expect a binomial distribution. That 50% of the time, one of the two is active and foraging, and the other one is resting. 25% of the time, 25% of the time both are foraging, and 25% of the time both are resting. If, however, you have individuals interacting, so you have stimuli being exchanged between the individuals that tend to synchronize them, you expect to see something like this, where very soon you get to these oscillations where everybody's foraging, everybody's resting, everybody's foraging, everybody's resting. Now, how does this then compare with what you actually observe in colonies of caterpillars? And so what this data is here is the example of groups of 10. On the bottom panel here is the position of the caterpillars along an arena. So don't look at that. Look at the top panel. The first thing worth mentioning on this graph is that this graph is 24 hours. So this was done with video. So instead of having somebody sit there watching this for 24 hours, we had it videotaped. And we then extract from the video simply the number of pixels that change in time, where that's an index of the number of caterpillars moving. Given that everything else in the image is quiet, changing pixels means moving caterpillars. And so what you see here is you have this clear alternation between peaks with lots of activity going on, lots of caterpillars moving, practically none. Activity, none. Activity, none. You know, lots of activity here, none. So you have very strong synchronization of that activity, this oscillation between periods where everybody's moving and everybody's quiet. And interestingly enough, too, this is fairly periodic as well.
It seems that it's growing.
Yeah. That's because in this particular case, what's happening is they're changing the place where they put the resting spot. So you can see that on the axis, on this graph here, where the kind of 300 millimeter position is the food source. So here they're at the food source, and here they're all resting at about 250. So when they move from 250 to 300, you see some but not a lot of movement. What's happened here is they've changed their resting space back to down here. And why they've done that, that was because they wanted to. Well, there's that whole thing about how under precisely controlled conditions, experimental animals will always, you know, invariably do exactly whatever it is they want. And sometimes you can understand what that is, sometimes we don't. So there's obviously something else here. So in this case, because they're moving over a farther distance, you see more activity happening than you do here moving over a smaller distance. Mm-hmm. But you've still got that kind of oscillation between activity and non-activity. Okay, so that then raises the question here too, but what's the functional significance of this? What does this do for caterpillars? And for these caterpillars, there's one function of their system, part of their biology that's important that I haven't mentioned, and that's that they're trail-based foragers. So they can't see very well. And the way that they reach food sources is they follow trails laid by other caterpillars. So they will move in the absence of trail, but they're very reluctant to do so, and they'll only move very short distances. Once a caterpillar has moved, however, it deposits a pheromone trail, and the other individuals will follow that trail. So that's essentially what this is somebody's put an artificial trail of pheromone on a piece of paper, and everybody's following. So what that means in terms of foraging patterns is that for a trail to be constructed, this obviously works much better if you have lots of individual active than if you have few individual active. But to demonstrate that, I've got a bit of video sequence here of caterpillar activities. Now the resolution here isn't great, it's limited by the camera. You've essentially got three groups of caterpillars here. I suggest you look at the middle group for this time around, where they're resting on a bivouac here, at one end of what's basically a one-dimensional arena, which is the stick along here. You have a food source at the other end. And what we're going to see here is an activity belt. So we're not going to see the alternation between resting and activity. We're just going to see activity, but we're going to see the type of activity that they have when they're exploring a new environment and laying down trail. Another thing worth mentioning is that this is time-lapse. So instead of having 30 frames per second, we've got 1 frame per 2 seconds, which basically means 1 minute here, 1 second here represents 1 minute in the real world, 1 minute here is an hour in the real world. So it's much sped up. So watch the middle one. So what you see here is they're becoming active, but they're reluctant to go beyond where there's trail. So as soon as an individual reaches a point, trail gets laid, everybody goes back and forth and back and forth, quite happily when there's trail. They gradually explore a little bit farther, extend the trail a little bit further. They eventually reach the food, feed on the food, and here they've started settling a new resting spot or a new bivouac close to the food. Now that was an hour and a half, which tells you something about the pace of caterpillar motion. Given that we've got such a long time, we'll take another hour and a half and do it again. You might want to watch one of the other groups this time. It's essentially the same process happening. Of movement over the place where trail has been formed, but reluctance to go beyond that area of trail. And essentially what that means is if you have a system of foraging like this, the extension of your trail will be much more efficient if you're the greater the number of individuals that are active. So if you have synchronization, everybody's active at the same time, they'll be more efficient at laying trails and taking those trails far. Okay, so what I've shown here essentially has been two systems in which you get synchronization of behavior within groups of animals to a greater or lesser degree depending on the system that we're working at. But we're basically looking at the same mechanisms. Now in terms of functional explanation, the functional explanation seems to be very different. So in locusts, it seems that synchronization acts as a feedback loop to drive the system to either the gregarious or the solitarious state. In caterpillars, it seems that synchronization is fundamental to the type of collective foraging that they show, which is based on this formation of trails, which requires a large number of individuals being active. There are obviously a lot of other biological systems in which you get synchronization of activity. The functional explanation there can differ between the different systems. So for the firefly system, for instance, it doesn't seem obvious that there's any functional significance at all. You know, fireflies synchronize their flashing. Does it make any difference to the fireflies? It's not sure. It might just be a kind of interesting side effect that's, you know, cool to observe, but it may or may not have any kind of adaptive significance. If we start looking at other systems more generally, the first obvious one to look at is groups of social insects other than caterpillars, so things like ants. And it's been suggested, again here there's a number of theories, but one possible explanation is that synchronization of activity improves the efficiency of foraging, or improves the efficiency of accomplishing tasks when they are tasks that require a large number of individuals active at the same time. So ants form pheromone trails that guide foraging, but ant pheromones are extremely volatile. They evaporate rapidly. So if you only have a few ants active, the trails will evaporate faster than the individuals can go back and forth and back and forth to use them. So you really need a large number of ants active foraging in order to maintain the trail. If you're a small colony, the best way to have a large number of individuals active is to synchronize the activity. And so foraging is an activity that's more efficient if everybody forages now and then everybody does something else later rather than everybody following their own schedule. And this might be true for other tasks as well. So that's one possible kind of functional explanation for why synchronization is useful. Another possible example here at a completely different level of biological organization is the pacemaker cells in the heart. So everybody knows that the heart is a muscle. It's made up of a lot of cells. Those heart cells all have to contract in sync. If they don't contract in sync, well, this is fibrillation, and that's very bad, and they usually die. Now, we know, however, that the heart as an oscillator is one that's driven by a reference oscillator, and that's called the pacemaker. So the heart's pacemaker gives the beat, and the rest of the heart cells follow that. So it's a different kind of mechanism altogether. However, if we look at the pacemaker itself, if we look at natural heart pacemakers, they're a cluster of about 10,000 cells. Each one of those is an oscillator. So you separate it in a petri dish and it'll oscillate. You put those 10,000 pacemaker cells together, they oscillate in sync. And obviously having the 10,000 cells in the pacemaker of your heart in synchrony is important to have your heart function. Now what's the advantage of having 10,000 pacemaker cells instead of one? Well, the first obvious one is redundancy. You know, if you lose one cell, you've still got 9,999, which is kind of a good thing. And the other one is that it increases the strength of the signal. That 10,000 cells together will be able to be much stronger signal than one on its own. So that's another possible functional explanation for why synchronization is a good thing. And that's one that's becoming used that can be applicable to kind of technological situations. So this is just one example of this that's been published in Nature fairly recently, where they're looking at using nano-oscillators in telecommunications. Now these nano-oscillators being nano, obviously emit very weak signals that aren't really usable, but it's been shown that if you have arrays of these nano-oscillators together, they synchronize each other, and then they produce a signal that's strong enough to be usable. Okay, so finally, the main point I wanted to have here is that synchronization occurs in a wide range of different biological systems. Many of these systems seem to be explained by this simple mechanism of individuals oscillating on their own and then bringing the phase of those oscillations into synchronization. So this is a pretty simple yet very robust mechanism that can explain synchronization even in very large groups of oscillators. And so finally, I just got left to thank first of all the people involved in this work. So the people have been involved in various different ways in the locust work, in the caterpillar work, and then finally the funding sources. Thank you.